No.
Okay, I think we can take this off. Our second speaker today is Hubert Bray, and he will talk about the Penrose area mass inequality.
Well, thank you for inviting me to speak. So the Penrose mass area inequality was my thesis problem, which Rick gave to me about 5 years ago. And it's certainly a problem I've enjoyed thinking about quite a bit. And recently there's been a lot of progress made on this problem. So it concerns black holes and general relativity, and it's related to understanding quasi-local mass and general relativity. And in particular, the Penrose inequality is a statement that says that in an asymptotically flat space-time, the total mass, the ADM mass of the space-time should be greater than or equal to the area of, to the mass of a black hole in your space-time. So it's a very compelling physical idea, and it motivates some very interesting Riemannian geometry. So the context is we're, excuse me? Actually, I'm going to use the talk board here in a second. So, okay, I'll push that up a bit. So also, you don't need to worry about these too much because all of the neat stuff I'm actually going to save to write myself, and these are just kind of for your context. So we're in an asymptotically flat space-time in, and we're going to take a slice M3, which is maximal, and later we'll actually assume it's a time-symmetric slice, or we could think of it as initial data. And then the Einstein equation, together with the positivity condition on the stress-energy tensor, I imply that for such a maximal slice, the scalar curvature of the of M is actually greater than or equal to zero. And so it's always good to, I think, at least if you're like me, I think it's always good to start with some examples of such manifolds. In particular, you know, what is the mass geometrically? Try to get a feel for that. And so we have this formula for the ADM mass, which you've probably all seen many times. And it's a very nice way of, so there's a lot of work to show this is actually an invariant of the metric. It doesn't actually depend on a coordinate chart. But let me draw a picture. So the idea is we have a metric which is asymptotic to R3 outside of a compact set. Down such a metric, then we can define coordinates, gijs, to the asymptotic flat coordinate chart, which converges to delta ij, and also the derivatives converge in a sufficiently nice manner. And then it's been shown that this is an invariant of the metric. And in some sense, what is the ADM mass? But you can think of it as how fast the metric becomes flat at infinity. And so in particular, as an example, we can take R3 as the standard flat metric. And this has zero mass. In fact, it's the only zero mass metric. And again, we're in the context of manifolds with non-negative scalar curvature. And of course, this is a very weak curvature assumption. It's simply scalar curvature, of course, is just a number at each point. So it's much weaker than, say, a Ricci curvature lower bound, which is more common. And so in terms of trying to get control on your metric, this is a fairly weak curvature assumption. And then if we have something which is a perturbation of R3, then this would be smaller mass. And then something which takes a much longer time to become flat, then that would be M larger. And some good examples are to look at metrics which are conformal to R3. And we still want to require that the scalar curvature is greater than or equal to zero. And this condition actually implies that the conformal factor U of X is superharmonic. So the Laplacian is negative. And we want it to be asymptotically flat. And so we need u of x to converge to some constant at infinity. And in this situation here, we actually have this constant converging to 1. And more generally, let's go ahead and let this constant converge to anything. U of x converge to any constant greater than 0. And the fact that u of x is superharmonic by the maximum principle implies that u of x is actually greater than or equal to A everywhere. So now, what is the mass? Well, let's go ahead and require that even though it's superharmonic everywhere, let's go ahead and require that U is harmonic outside a ball of radius R. Then we can expand U in terms of spherical harmonics outside this ball of radius R. So it goes to the constant A. Then the next spherical harmonic is 1 over R. So we have some constant V over distance from the origin. And then there are these lower order spherical harmonics. So I'll just write big O 1 over R squared. And it turns out for such an asymptotically flat metric, which is conformal to R3, then the total mass is just equal to twice A times B. So this is a very convenient definition of mass to work with in this very special setting where your metric is conformal to R3. In fact, I am going to take this as the definition of mass, or it's the formula for mass, which I'm going to use, because there's a very nice lemma by Shane and Yao, which Rick referred to in the first talk this morning, which says that given any asymptotically flat manifold, you can always, with non-negative scalar curvature, you can always perturb it in a very, very small amount, such that outside some bounded region, your metric is actually conformal to R3. Minus the ball, radius R. And in fact, the Shane Yao lemma says you can do this perturbation such that you actually have identically zero scalar curvature outside this compact set. And this is a result of Shane Yao's in their original positive mass theorem papers. Right, and since this is zero scalar curvature and it's conformal to R3, then we're in this setting. We can write down the conformal factor U of X, and then once we've done that, we can just compute the mass to be 2AB. And in fact, we can actually prove the positive mass theorem in this very special setting where we're conformal to R3. It's a very it's very nice that it works out to be so straightforward. And we're using the fact that U of X is superharmonic. Then we know that U of X is greater than or equal to A everywhere in R3 because minimum value of a superharmonic function is always achieved on the boundary. And therefore, by assumption, A was positive. And since U of X is greater than or equal to A everywhere, and this is the next highest order term, B must also be greater than or equal to 0. And so, therefore, M, 2AB, must be greater than or equal to 0 for manifolds which are conformal to R3. Now, of course, this proof of the positive mass theorem does not work in the more general case, where you have some arbitrary manifold, which is simply conformal to R3 outside of a compact set. And in fact, the positive mass theorem is a very amazing theorem. It's geometrically, it's quite an amazing statement. It uses this very weak curvature assumption and tells you that something about the decay of the metric at infinity. So what is the Penrose inequality? Well, for this talk, we're just going to look at the time-symmetric case. So in this setting, our slice now is going to be a time-symmetric slice of space-time. And then it so happens that if you have a surface which locally minimizes area. So in this picture, of course, everything is one dimension lower. So these are two-dimensional spheres here. If they locally minimize area, or in fact they just have zero mean curvature sufficient, then they correspond to apparent horizons in the four-dimensional space-time, apparent horizons of black holes. And there's a very beautiful physical motivation which suggests that the mass of these black holes, even if there are multiple black holes, that if you look at the area divided by 16 pi and take the square root, that should be the mass of these collection of black holes. And by reasonable physical argument, since we're assuming that we have non-negative scalar curvature everywhere in the manifold, which is equivalent to non-negative energy density, then it's reasonable to conjecture that the ADM mass of the manifold should be greater than or equal to the square root of the A over 16 pi. So I'll point out here that in the original motivation, A is the total area of all the components of these horizons. So normally you would think of these as separate black holes, and so maybe it's not natural to think of it together as one object, but in fact that's the approach that I'm taking, that given any surface which has zero mean curvature could have multiple components, we'll call that actually A horizon, which is natural for various mathematical considerations we might get into later, and then we have this inequality. So there are several conditions that make this problem kind of a subtle problem. You see this is a very beautiful geometric problem. I mean, here we have these minimal spheres with zero mean curvature, and somehow or another when we have non-negative scalar curvature on the manifold, and that controls the behavior of the manifold at infinity. And so we need to look at the case of equality. And there's also, let me show you one thing that makes this problem very subtle. And in fact, let me show you a counterexample to the Penrose inequality. So we'll just stay in the spherically symmetric case. To really get an intuition for this problem, the first thing to do is just look at spherically symmetric Riemannian manifolds with non-negative scalar curvature. And in fact, you can really gain a lot of understanding by looking at this situation. And since they're spherically symmetric, we're really just studying functions of one variable. The metric is just a function of one variable. It's supposed to be spherically symmetric. And so we can define the mass at infinity here, the ADM mass. And in fact, the Penrose inequality only applies to this horizon. It only applies to outermost horizons. Or more generally, you can actually apply it only to surfaces. When I say horizon, by the way, I define a horizon to be a surface in the three manifold which has zero mean curvature, and which is the boundary of a region, so it's embedded. And so this horizon is not contained by any other horizons, and so the Penrose inequality applies to that horizon. However, there's also a horizon here. Whenever you have something which locally minimizes area, the first variation tells you that the mean curvature is zero. And we can see this locally minimizes area in the spherically symmetric manifold. So it has zero mean curvature. It is a horizon, but it's not an outermost horizon. And in fact, it's possible to, if you didn't put this outermost condition in the statement, then you could generate these counterexamples, because I could make a spherically symmetric manifold here which goes out as far as you want and put a little dimple in there and make the area of the horizon as large as you want, in which case, of course, this term would be very, very large. But the mass at infinity here, which is just the decay rate of the metric, is staying fixed. Right. So this is what makes this problem quite subtle. Like, how do you not only detect a horizon, but how do you detect a horizon that's not contained by another horizon? And more generally, actually, what you need are horizons which are not contained by smaller horizons. So as long as this horizon stayed smaller than the outermost horizon, it would be okay. So that's... Let me, at this point, pass out a handout, which I have. And this is supposed to save you some time taking notes and just something you can scribble on. It also summarizes the statements of the theorems which I'm going to make precisely, so that I don't have to feel obligated to make the precise statements here, which would go very quickly anyway, and you probably wouldn't get... Yeah?
Does it make sense to take limits in which m and a both go to 0?
Which m goes to 0?
M and A both go to 0.
I'm sorry, M goes to 0?
Does it make sense to look at for this inequality in the limit in which M, A, D, M, and A both go to zero?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's a lot of interesting questions in that direction. Of course, everything scales, right? So you could always take any metric and then scale it down. Mass has units of length, and of course area has units of length squared. So these are both units of length on both sides. So you just shrink lengths. And this is actually a fairly interesting kind of point. Take any manifold, that one for example. By shrinking the lengths, you can make it very, very small. And then the mass be very, very small, and it look like R3 on this large scale. But even so, you can still have some very interesting topology. I mean, you could have connected these two components, in which case this guy would have topology. So, you know, kind of characterizing what the positive mass theorem says, that the only zero mass metric is R3. And trying to understand, well, what if you have a very small mass metric? How close to R3 is the metric? It's certainly an interesting question. Maybe during the discussion session, if you ask the question again, I can comment more about that. So how do you approach a problem like this? Well, in the 70s, Jang and Wald had a very nice suggestion for an approach, generalizing some techniques of Garoche. And actually, this is not only very nice mathematics, but it's a very interesting just human story, I think, how all these ideas have come together. So it's quite amazing to me. And maybe some people here could even comment more on the history of how this happened. But now let's let the plane of the projector here be the three manifold. And so sigma, which initially is the horizon, will be given by this sphere. I just put in one component in this case. And so Hawking defined this mass functional. And you might say, well, where did he come up with this very bizarre looking formula? Well, I haven't asked him personally, but I think what must have been the case is that he's simply looking at the spherically symmetric case. In fact, Hawking defined this Hawking mass. I remember shifting my attention to the time symmetric case, but there's actually a Hawking mass in the general second fundamental form case, which is a generalization of this. And really, if you just familiarize yourself with the spherically symmetric case, then you're forced to choose this formula. And in fact, then if you flow along spherically symmetric spheres, then this quantity is monotone. The farther you flow out, the larger it gets, assuming, again, the non-negative energy condition. And one thing that's very nice about it, going back to the Penrose inequality, so what's the Penrose inequality? Is that the ADM mass is greater than or equal to the square root of the area of the horizon over 16 pi. Well, notice that if you have a horizon, as I mentioned before, the first variation formula tells you the mean curvature is 0. H here is the mean curvature. So mean curvature being the trace of the second fundamental form of sigma 2 in M3. So everything I'm doing is in the 3 manifold. I'm not going to have any reference to the 4 manifold to speak of. Space-time to speak of. So this is 0 for horizon. So this is just 1, so you get the square root of A over 16 pi. So for horizon, this is the Hawking mass of a horizon. And the idea is that if you could just find a family of surfaces starting at the horizon and flowing out to infinity, which works in the spherically symmetric case, just take all the spherically symmetric spheres, which is always increasing, as this quantity is in the spherically symmetric case, then as long as this converges to the ADM mass for very large spheres at infinity, which it does, and that's something you can check just by direct computation. Take a large sphere and an Aspaki flat manifold, you can check that this converges to ADM mass. Well, then by the monotonicity of it, that would prove the Penrose inequality. So this was the idea that Jang and Wald proposed. And in fact, they actually came up with a flow which works, amazingly enough. And this is what I find very amazing. I mean, I think, so Hawking wrote this down as a natural guess for what, and this is an example of a quasi-local mass function. This is supposed to be how much mass is inside sigma. You can think of it that way. And so what Yang and Wald and Garoche observed was that if you flow this surface by this very special flow, so you flow out in the normal directions, and the rate at which you're flowing out is equal to 1 over the mean curvature. So it's inverse mean curvature flow. then if you compute the rate of change of the Hawking mass of these surfaces, then in fact you get this expression by just direct calculation. You have to use the Gauss equation, but it's, I just get maybe, you know, 5 or 6 lines of geometric calculations there. And since we're assuming non-negative scalar curvature on our manifold, this is positive.
Can you move that up a little?
Oh, sure. So since we're, can you see? Okay. So since we're assuming non-negative scalar curvature on our manifold, this term is positive. This is just the scalar curvature of the 3 manifold. So that's positive. This K is the Gauss curvature of sigma. So as you are familiar, there's this Gauss-Bonnet theorem for surfaces. So K here is just the intrinsic curvature of sigma. So by the Gauss-Bonnet theorem, the integral of the Gauss curvature for a sphere is 4 pi. So when you integrate this, you get a negative 8 pi divided by 16 pi, you get negative 1/2, that cancels with that. And so you get 0 canceling there, and then R is greater than or equal to 0, so this term here is greater than or equal to 0. So it's really very beautiful the way that works out. And the only problem is, and so this is, for a long time, was classified as a heuristic proof or a proof that works in as long as, you know, certain singularities don't develop. And the problem is singularities in the flow, because what if H equals 0 during the flow? We want to flow by 1 over the mean curvature. What if the mean curvature goes to 0? And this is a, you know, pretty serious problem. And many of you have probably heard about the Hüsken-Ullmann result. And basically what they did was they figured out how to fix this problem by generalizing the flow a little bit. It turns out that you can make this flow actually defined for all t and start at a horizon and flow out to infinity. Now, you might already be worried that the horizon has zero mean curvature. So right off the bat, you're in bad shape, right? I mean, H is not only zero at some points, it's zero everywhere, right? But Jang and Wald recognize the fact that just by flowing out just a little bit, then you can get a surface with slightly positive mean curvature, so at least you can get off to a good start. And just to summarize a 70-page or 80-page result of Hüsken-Ullmann in one picture. So, which I think is that gets captures the main idea. What do they do? So you start with the original horizon sigma naught. You flow out for a while. And what they do at each point is, now suppose you get into a situation where, let's go like this. They really have two things going on at the same time. And let me describe it. This is not the way they really define it, but this is effectively what's happening. So you're flowing out by the inverse mean curvature all the time. However, at each step, each time you increase flow out just a little bit, you ask the question, is this surface at time t, is it contained by a surface with less area? So, for example, this surface here is contained by a surface with less area. This surface here, for example. In fact, many surfaces have less area. And if so, if at any point it's contained by a surface with less area, then you jump out to that surface. And in fact, you always jump out to the outermost surface, which contains that least amount of area. If there might be several surfaces with less area. For example, here, there are lots of surfaces which have less area, in which case you jump out to the outermost surface, which minimizes area outside of it. So what happens is that every once in a while you might get a little dimple like this, and every once in a while the flow pops. And it all of a sudden jumps from this surface to this surface. And since this outermost minimal surface locally minimizes area, this has zero mean curvature on this region where it popped. And also, since it minimizes area, it's locally stable, so you can flow it out to have slightly positive mean curvature. Now, when it pops, we don't know, for example, that this Hawking mass quantity is still stayed monotone. And that's something we have to check. But it so happens that this popping phenomenon does not decrease the Hawking mass. And the reason is that actually the popping never changes the area. And why is that? Well, the area doesn't increase because it only pops out to surfaces with less area or less than or equal area. On the other hand, the area never decreases, because if it decreased, that meant there, at some point in the past, this surface had already been out there with less area than the current surface, and so it would have popped at some point beforehand. And so by these two arguments, the area, when it pops, actually stays exactly the same. And so in this popping procedure, the area stays the same. And furthermore, the mean curvature on this region equals zero, and it agrees everywhere else since the surface didn't change at all. And so you've gone from non-zero mean curvature, possibly, to zero mean curvature, so the integral of h squared actually decreases. And since there's a negative sign there, it means this increases. That stayed the same, so the Hawking mass increases. So this popping procedure increases the Hawking mass. And then with some, just checking the first variation formula, you can check that surfaces which are not contained by surfaces with less area always have non-negative mean curvature. And you can always perturb them slightly to have surfaces with positive mean curvature by stability, and so that this flow can always continue. So that's kind of a hand-wavy representation of what their argument in effect does. So it's a very, very nice idea, very, very clever. And so now there is one limitation which is worth pointing out, and that is, I mentioned it that the original Penrose conjecture, you could have multiple components, as in this situation. So the original physical motivation which led Penrose to make this conjecture said that sigma could have multiple components, in which case A is just the area, the total area of the two components. And if you look at the monotonicity formula for this Hawking mass, what we notice is that you have this integral of Gauss curvature. And so there, I use the fact that the integral of the Gauss curvature equals 4 pi using the Gauss-Bonnet formula. But in fact, well, what if you have two spheres? Well, then the integral of the Gauss curvature equals 8 pi. And in general, it could equal any multiple of 4 pi with any number of spheres. And so you only get integral of the Gauss curvature less than or equal to 4 pi if you have one component. And if you have multiple components, then you can actually violate this inequality. And so you don't have monotonicity if sigma has multiple components. So the Huskin-Imlin result still gives you an inequality, but what you have to do is, if you have multiple horizons, as in, say, this picture here, your surface, you just have to start on one of the horizons and then flow out, starting with that on that horizon, to infinity. And the inequality you get is simply that the ADM mass is less than or equal to the square root of the area of any one component divided by 16 pi. So you might as well choose the largest component. So instead of getting the area, you get the A largest, area of the largest component. Still, though, it's definitely a breakthrough, because it's the first time the time symmetric Penrose inequality had been proven in such generality. So there's, let me at this point draw a sketch of the Schwarzschild metric. So this is, again, it's always important to look at examples. And the Schwarzschild metric is certainly a very interesting and helpful example. And in the positive mass theorem, R3 is conjectured, or was proven to be the only zero mass metric. And the natural conjecture for the Penrose conjecture was to guess that the only case of equality in the Penrose inequality, so let's put this back up there, that we have inequality here, and that you only get equality in for a Schwarzschild metric, which is, of course, just a black hole in vacuum, non-rotating. And so when we take a time symmetric slice, then what does this metric look like? It turns out that, well, there's several ways you can write it. You can write conformal to R3, so you can say Gij equals 1 plus m over 2 norm x to the fourth power delta ij. So if you take this on R3 minus the origin, then this gives you the Schwarzschild metric, 3 metric. Schwarzschild. And it's always nice to draw a picture. Guess what we can see is that this conformal factor is blowing up as x goes to 0, the length of x goes to 0. And so, in fact, you can embed this three-dimensional manifold into four-dimensional Euclidean space. So, again, just normal Euclidean Riemannian geometry here. So, let's have a w-coordinate. And then this, the x-axis will represent three coordinates, x, y, and z. And then let's take a parabola here, which is the length of x, y, z equals w squared over 8m plus 2m. So m is just a parameter and equals the mass of the Schwarzschild metric. And so if you take this parabola as a function of w, and then you rotate, because this is actually three dimensions, so we're going to be rotating around an S2. This is an S2 here. Then take the standard metric on R4, and then take the induced metric on this three-manifold, then this is isometric to this Schwarzschild metric. So this is a picture of the Schwarzschild metric. And in fact, from before, I said, remember, the mass equals 2ab. So if you expand in terms of these conformal factors, a is 1 here, b is m over 2, and so you make the compute 2ab, you get m. So m, in fact, is the mass. And well, what's the area of the horizon? Well, you can just, it's just a sphere right here, and you can actually compute, well, what is the area of that sphere? And in fact, you can verify that you get equality in this inequality. And this is conjecture. This is the only case of equality for the Penrose inequality. So recently, I came up with a proof which actually proves this inequality in the multiple component case. So I'd like to present that to you now. But to do that, I'm going to go off on a little bit of a tangent. And this is mathematics, but it's reasonably, very nice motivation of what I'm going to do, even though it will seem like it's quite a bit of a tangent. So let's talk about conformal metrics. Yeah?
You see, the Bessel was only for single component.
Right.
And it is really true that you get a linear foliation, that there is no, all these two surfaces are smooth.
So you get a lamination.
Like,
lamination meaning that it jumps. So it doesn't fill space, but there sometimes are jumps.
Right.
And
but wherever the surface lies.
So the surfaces, they're not smooth, but I think they're like C1 or something like that, or approximately.
Smooth enough in order to compute the mean curvature, like H.
Right. And actually, they define the flow very weakly. So what they actually do is they get into the technicalities. They define a scalar function on the manifold such that these surfaces are the level sets of that scalar function. And that allows them to, and then they take these inverse mean curvature flow and translate to in terms of the scalar function. And then this type of jumping phenomenon, and they actually minimize an energy functional, and this type of jumping phenomenon actually occurs naturally in the way they set up the problem. So it's very, very nice.
And that scalar function is what is C2 or something, so therefore you know.
Well, so I'll refer the question's exact aspects of their flow to them. I'm not, but there's some sort of regularity, not too far from that, which certainly allows you to define this flow, right? So any other questions? So let me, conformal metrics. So two metrics are conformal. So I'll leave off the subscripts ij, but all these metrics, so this is a gij with lower subscripts. So g2 is conformal to g1 if you can define a conformal factor u of x, I'll go ahead and put a fourth power here, times g1. So g1 and g2 are conformal. All right. And in fact, you can define a relation, you say G2 is related to G1. Let me give myself some more space. So G2 is related to G1 if they're conformal. And that's a relation, and then you can check that that's actually an equivalence relation, which means that every metric is related to itself, that this relation is symmetric, and it's transitive. So if G1 is related to G2 and G2 is related to G3, then G1 is related to G3. Okay. And then you can split all metrics into these conformal classes. So this is standard, something that you're all familiar with. So now let's define a relation, which is a little bit more bizarre, because what we're going to do is, again, U has to be positive. We're going to require that U, with respect to the metric G1, is harmonic. So we're still going to define a relation, but as you can see, the very definition is not symmetric, right? So U has to be harmonic with respect to the metric G1, but it's certainly not clear under what circumstances is it symmetric, because you need, for it to be symmetric, you need 1 over U to be harmonic in the metric G2. And so what's surprising, though, is that actually this, even though it's not defined in a symmetric way, this equivalence relation, this actually is an equivalence relation. In fact, this relation is symmetric and transitive. And the reason follows from this formula, which describes how the conformal, how the Laplacians change under change of conformal factor. So this is the definition of the equivalence. So we have this identity, which is really neat. Looks too simple to be true. By the way, this works in dimension n greater than or equal to 3. So B here is any test, smooth test function. U is the conformal factor relating G2 and G1. This is the Laplacian in respect to the metric G1. This is the Laplacian in respect to the metric G2. And so happens you get this identity, sort of a product rule. But this is very strange because this is a second order operator. So you'd expect there to be these linear terms over here, the gradients of U and phi, but they are absorbed by grouping the terms in just the right way. And then what you can see then is that let phi equal 1 over U. Well, if phi equals 1 over U, then this product here is just 1. 1 is a harmonic function in any metric. And so therefore, if Laplacian U equals 0, so Laplacian in the first metric of U equals 0, implies then, and is implied by, okay, phi equals 1 over U, so that's 0. This is 0, therefore that's 0. And therefore, Laplacian in the second metric of phi, which is 1 over U, is 0. So that proves this is a symmetric equivalence relation. And in fact, this same formula allows you to show that it's transitive. And so what you get, just like in conformal metrics, you get harmonic. I define this to be harmonic conformal metrics. And so you can talk about the harmonic conformal class of a metric. So given a metric, put a subscript H there, and we'll just define that to be all metrics G bar such that G bar is related to G. Here's this definition here. Another nice feature of this harmonic conformal class of metrics is that it preserves the sign of scalar curvature. If you compute what is the scalar curvature of G2, going back to this formula, then turns out, this is a formula that is used a lot in discussions with scalar curvature, Yamabe problem, whatnot. So this is how, given a two conformally related metrics, this is the scalar curvature of the second metric in terms of the scalar curvature of the first metric. So then you see if that U is harmonic, this term in fact crosses out. And so then the scalar curvature of G2 just equals some conformal factor times scalar curvature of G1. So the scalar curvature just transforms conformally, just based on units. And so therefore the sign of the scalar curvature of G2 equals the sign of the scalar curvature of G1. So in particular, well, let's go back to the Penrose inequality. I mean, this makes it seem like a very natural object to study because we have manifolds with non-negative scalar curvature. And so if we look at the harmonic conformal class of the original metric, then all of the other metrics in that harmonic conformal class will also have non-negative scalar curvature. And so in fact, since I was interested in the Penrose inequality, the first question that occurred to me is, let's define the Penrose quotient of a metric. equal the mass of the metric. So this metric is an asymptotically flat metric with non-negative scalar curvature. Look at the total mass m divided by the square root of the area of the metric, which I'm going to define the area of the metric just to be the area of the outermost horizon, which in this case would be sigma. And this, so you can see I got this from the Penrose inequality just by taking the square root of a to the other side. And this is a scale invariant quantity. And then you can say, well, minimize P of G in the harmonic conformal class of G. And if you believe that the Penrose inequality is true, then the minimum situation should be a Schwarzschild metric. It's very asymmetric, is zero scalar curvature. By the way, I just going back to the Schwarzschild metric, which I erased, is that parabola rotated. One way to characterize this three-dimensional metric is that it's spherically symmetric and it has zero scalar curvature. And it's all such metrics which have that property and are complete. So with that motivation in mind, you can define a conformal flow of metrics. So we're going to start with some initial metric. Now I've changed the picture to where it's just one component to the horizon. So sigma naught's the original horizon, just easier to draw. And so what we're going to do is we want to stay inside this harmonic conformal class of the original metric. And so to do that, we take our original metric G naught and multiply by some harmonic conformal factor and use the T of x to the fourth power. And so the idea is I'm actually going to take the original metric and flow it and try to flow it in such a way that this Penrose quotient is always decreasing and then see what happens. And hopefully flow to a Schwarzschild metric or something that we understand. So this, again, it's a monotonicity type of argument, fairly similar to the Yang-Wald-Grosch type of idea. Except now we're flowing the metric, not the horizon. So as you change the metric, the horizon will change, though. So the horizon will still be defined to be the a zero mean curvature surface of the new metric. So we haven't said what u is yet, but this is what the metric at time t is, just conformally related to g naught. Sigma of t is just defined to be the outermost minimal area enclosure of the original horizon sigma naught in the new metric at time t. So sigma of t doesn't minimize area in this metric g naught, but if I drew the other metric g sub t, then it would be a horizon. It would locally minimize area and be the minimal area enclosure of the original horizon sigma naught. And then the question is, what we're going to do is we're going to define this function v to be the rate of change of u. So if we look at this, we see this is the same thing as saying that d dt of u equals v. So v is going to be the rate of change of the conformal factor u. And it seems like we're making some wild conjectures here about how to define this flow, but we have the advantage of, we have a motivation. We want to stay inside this harmonic conformal class. Right? And so the harmonic conformal class means that these conformal factors have to be harmonic. So right off the bat, we know that the rate of change of u is harmonic. We know that the rate of change of u also has to be harmonic. So we're going to require v to be harmonic outside the horizon sigma of t. So then the only question is, well, what are the boundary conditions for v? And, well, we know that u has to be, that the new metric still has to be asymptotically flat. So the conformal factor u has to go to a constant at infinity. And so therefore, v has to go to a constant at infinity. And since you can really rescale this flow in any way you want to, you actually, the only thing that matters is the sign of this constant. You can make it negative 1 or positive 1. And it's just convenient to, the correct answer is negative 1. You could try to make it positive 1 and see what happens and discuss that maybe later. But actually what you want to do is shrink the metric outside the original horizon. You want to make it smaller so that the horizon always flows outward since it locally minimizes area. And so I'll just choose this scaling, which is most natural, negative e to negative t, so it's self-similar. And then the last question is, okay, well, what's the boundary condition for this harmonic function v on sigma of t? And of course, this is where I was stuck for a very long time, because you could choose Neumann boundary conditions, or you could choose Dirichlet boundary conditions, or a mixture of some kind. And it turns out this is the simplest thing you could write down is works, and it's the best thing. So we'll just require v to equal 0 on this interior boundary. And inside sigma of t, we'll just have v sub t just be identically 0. And basically, the Penrose inequality is really has to do with complete metrics which have a boundary, where it's okay for the horizon to be a boundary, and really the metric inside the horizon doesn't play a role in the Penrose inequality. Okay, so really the question is, why choose these t equal to 0 on sigma of t? And let me describe the motivation for that. So, back to this. So there are two things going on. As we flow the metric, the total mass of the manifold is changing, and the area of the horizon is changing. So then the horizon is moving also. So let's define A of t to equal the area of the horizon sigma of t, so the horizon at time t, inside the metric g sub t. So this is the area of the horizon after you float the metric for a while. By the way, maybe I should draw a picture. This would be good just to show you what these flows look like. So you start with your original arbitrary metric. Could have multiple components, but I'm just going to draw one for simplicity. And actually, I may draw two just because maybe I'll illustrate a point. Nice. So you have a couple of horizons here. And then this is at t equal to 0. So m3 comma g0. And then as you flow it for a while, see, you get something that looks like this. So this is the original horizon down here. And now the horizons have actually changed and moved out here. So this is sigma naught. There are two components here. So sigma naught are these two components, and then these two outer components are sigma of t, these two outermost components. So you can see sigma is flowing outwards, these two components. And what's going to happen is the way this flow is going to work, actually, at some later time, another horizon is, you can see, is forming around these first two. And in fact, there actually is a horizon here, but at this time, the area of this horizon still exceeds the area of the sum of those two horizons, so you don't jump yet. And so the way that it's defined is sigma of t is the outermost minimal area enclosure of the original guy. So these guys still are minimal area enclosures, where this is not globally minimal, it's just locally minimal. And so then at some point, it actually does become less area, and so it jumps out. So this is sigma of t2 here, this is t1, I guess. This is the original horizon, and then it flowed out, so in this direction. And at some point, it just jumped, all at once, jumped to this horizon. And then it will continue to flow up, and so then the picture continues until finally, what's the limit? This is a claim, which I haven't justified yet. What happens is the metric becomes Schwarzschild outside this single component. So this jumping procedure, what you can see happens actually is that the number of components of the horizon always decreases, never increases. There's no reason ever to increase the number of components. So eventually you just get down to one component. And then the metric, if you look at the way this flow is defined, you can see that it's sort of symmetrical in nature. And so in fact it does converge to a Schwarzschild metric with a very long cylinder. And then it goes very, very long. And then you have all your original interesting geometry down here. And so this is your original horizon. It flowed out. At some point it had this jump, and then became more and more spherically symmetric until eventually it becomes precisely spherically symmetric in the limit as t goes to infinity. Okay, well, why is this flow interesting? Well, the point is that to define this area, A of t, we also define the mass, m of t, to be the mass, the total mass of m3 comma g sub t. And what we want to show is this flow has the very nice property that a prime of t actually equals 0. And m prime of t is less than or equal to 0. And since so it's not clear that it has either of these properties, so it should definitely be a surprise. But certainly a very nice feature of this flow. It's really the main point. And so what happens is we have an arbitrary mass and area originally. You do this flow, eventually you get to the Schwarzschild metric. And in the Schwarzschild metric, you have equality. So m of infinity, use notation, let's take the limit, equals the square root of a of infinity over 16 pi. Since the area is not changing, this is the square root of a of t over a of 0, the original metric, over 16 pi. And since the mass is decreasing, this is always less than or equal to m of 0. And so that's a proof of the original Penrose inequality. So it all boils down to, well, are really two things. You have to prove that this flow converges to a Schwarzschild metric, which maybe I'll say for the question and answer period if people ask. But what I would like to discuss next is why are these quantities monotone? Maybe that's the first surprising thing. And in fact, let's look at this a prime of t. Why is the area of the horizon fixed? Well, if we just go back to this flow, we know that the horizon at any given point in time has zero mean curvature because it locally minimizes area for outward variations. And so what that means is that when you compute the rate of change of this quantity, you see that there are two time dependencies. Sigma of t is changing and g of t is changing. Well, the first order, when sigma of t flows out, because it has zero mean curvature, the area doesn't change the first order. So if the metrics were held fixed, the variation in sigma does not contribute to a prime of t. Well, what about the changing metric? Well, the metric is just this conformal factor u. The rate of change of u is v, and v equals 0 on sigma of t. So the first order, the change in the metric doesn't contribute to a prime of t either. And so, in fact, a prime of t then equals the sum of those two contributions, which are both 0, and so equals 0. And so that's the motivation for why we choose this flow. So you're forced into it. If you want to preserve the area, you have to choose v equal to 0. Because it's asymptotically flat, you have to choose v goes to some constant. And if we want to stay in this conformal harmonic conformal class, v has to be harmonic. So this flow is, you know, you're forced into it, really. So now, the more delicate thing is to show that the mass is decreasing. And that, certainly another thing that I wondered about for some time, and it's not really, it's such a naturally defined flow, I think it's worth thinking about, but you might certainly, I guess it's surprising to find out the mass actually does decrease. And so here's the summary of this argument, which we answer more questions about. The first point is that this flow, as I defined, was very naturally defined, and combined with this identity here with how Laplacian changes under a change of the conformal metric, it turns out that this flow here is natural in the sense that the rate of change of the metric at time t is actually a function of the metric at time t. So that's not clear because there are two types of dependencies going on. And first we have this e to the negative t here. That is a function of t, and so I'm claiming it's not a function of t, the rate of change of the metric. And also, this Laplacian, v is harmonic with respect to the metric g naught. So this g naught is still playing a role in this flow, not with respect to the metric g sub t. But it turns out because of this identity, you know, all these weird, nice things happen, this flow is defined just in terms of the metric at time t. And because of that, if we want to show that these quantities are, that the mass is monotone, we can simply show that m prime of 0 is less than or equal to 0, and that will apply that m prime of t is less than or equal to 0, too. So let's set t equal to 0. So this idea is in a paper by Bunting and Massoud in the, I guess it's early 80s, where they show that a vacuum static space-time is Schwarzschild. Some of these ideas. So you take your original horizon, and what we want to do is gain some information about this function v. The v was defined for t equal to 0 to be harmonic, and it went to negative 1 at infinity, the original horizon. And what I've done here, by the way, I took the original guy and I just reflected. So you cut away the manifold inside the horizon, and then you just reflect throughout the horizon. So this is now symmetric along this along the horizon. And what we're going to do is define V to go to negative 1 on this end, 1 on this end, and be harmonic everywhere. And by symmetry, it has to equal 0 on the horizon. And so therefore, since it equals 0 on the horizon, this is how we define V in the upper half here. So this is just a natural extension of the original harmonic function V. And it turns out that if you compute the rate of change of the metric, M prime is 0, which is what we're trying to estimate, you have to understand the behavior of the function V. It goes to minus 1 in this end, then plus, it's the 1 over R term which is important. Because the mass of a manifold is how fast it becomes flat at infinity. And so, going back to the fact that the, like I said, I erased it, but the mass equal to AB, where the conformal factor U sub T of X equals A plus B over norm X plus lower order terms. So we need to, this 1 over R term is really what affects the mass. And since V is the rate of change of U, what we really need to do is understand what is this 1 over R term for these manifolds with non-negative stellar curvature. And if you compute what M prime of T is, in fact, it equals twice that quantity C minus the mass of the original manifold here. And then by doing this reflection, the question is, I really want to use a big theorem to get some information. I mean, this is, in principle, a very hard problem. All we know is that V equals 0 here, goes to minus 1 at infinity. How could we possibly get information about its 1 over R decay? And in fact, you can't, in general. If the manifold is just some arbitrary metric, the fact that you have a horizon here tells you basically nothing. And really, it's the fact that the scalar curvature is non-negative that gives you any chance of estimating C. And so, you know, what theorems, what tools, one thing that's nice about this is actually an application of the positive mass theorem. Because the positive mass theorem is a very powerful theorem. It tells you something about manifolds with non-negative scalar curvature, so I was thinking, well, how could you apply it? So you do this reflection, and then you compactify one end. And so you notice that V goes to minus 1 here, so if we take V and add 1, this will still be a harmonic function. It goes to 0 in this end, and so when we multiply by this metric, G naught bar, then we compactify one end. And so these surfaces here are no longer minimal. We just drew them for reference. And you might be concerned, well, that the positive mass theorem is a theorem about complete manifolds. And here I have a point missing. But it turns out because by the Shane-Yau limit, we're assuming the metric was harmonically flat at infinity. It had this nice expansion at infinity. Then you can actually use a removable singularity theorem for harmonic functions to fill in that point. So you get a complete manifold with non-negative scalar curvature. Why does it have non-negative scalar curvature? Well, this guy had non-negative scalar curvature. When you reflect, it still has non-negative scalar curvature. And when you multiply by its harmonic conformal factor, recall that preserves the sign of scalar curvature. So this still has non-negative scalar curvature. And now you apply the positive mass theorem, which says that M tilde of 0 must be greater than or equal to 0. And then you get very lucky, and you observe that M tilde of 0 is just negative 4 times C minus M naught. And so in fact, this set of equalities and inequalities is correct. So M prime of 0 equals C minus M naught times 2, which equals negative 1/2 M tilde, which by the positive mass term is less than or equal to 0. And so therefore, the mass is monotone decreasing. And we have the monotonicity we need, which gives us the Penrose inequality. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions?
So I'd just like to make sure I have the right picture here. If I start with the general three metric, asymptotically flat, with positive scalar curvature, whatever you want, it's not going to be true. I can conformally rescale it to Schwarzschild or something spherically symmetric. But if I understand correctly, what you're doing is taking into account the fact that you have a hole, this sort of horizon, and you're shrinking everything down so that you're using the fact that the original metric sort of asymptotically looked like Schwarzschild near infinity, right, and then rescaled it so that everything got swallowed up by the horizon but this spherically symmetric, asymptotically flat metric, and you cleverly did it so that the area of this hole never changed and That's the right picture?
That's the right picture. So that is kind of a neat objection that you might have. And that's a very good question. I mean, somehow or another, we took some arbitrary metric, and next thing you know, we multiplied by a conformal factor, and we've got Schwarzschild. Right, well, what if the original metric wasn't in the same conformal class as Schwarzschild? I mean, how is this possible? And I guess the point is that we're assuming the metric is asymptotically flat, and R3 minus the ball is in the conformal class of Schwarzschild. And so then in the limit, is this, in fact, if we assume by the chain Yau limit that's harmonically flat at infinity, that's conformal to R3 minus the ball outside a compact set, then eventually this horizon goes into that region where it's conformal to R3 minus a finite set, and then is in the conformal class outside the horizon. And then all of the interesting geometry of the manifold got sucked into the horizon and buried deep, deep inside of it. Since there are a lot of physicists here, I mean, it is kind of interesting, some sort of analogy here, what's going on. I mean, everything outside the horizon got sucked in, right? And it settled down to a Schwarzschild. So angular momentum is not being accounted for here. So I don't have any momentum because since everything's a time-symmetric case, but so maybe things could be adapted, but it's certainly kind of interesting curiosity that this is a first order flow in time, by the way. And then you still get the same type of behavior. It's kind of curious.
Just some clarifications. I mean, so in this case, as you're doing this flow, is it or is it not true that this horizon can jump?
Yes.
So then how did you conclude that the mass of the A prime of t is always equal to zero?
Okay.
Even when the jump occurs?
That's a very good question. So basically, to actually prove that A prime of t equals zero is, you know, it's a long technical question. So to do it right. In fact, just the existence of this flow is a reasonably long technical question just to show this flow exists. I mean, you can write down an ODE in time, and there are plenty of examples which don't have solutions at all, right? So there's a lot of work there. But let's just go ahead and stick with the heuristic, you know, get the idea, I mean, which certainly convinced me initially and hopefully will convince you, is that you have to ask, well, when do these things choose to jump? And it's really the same argument as the Hüsken-Ilmanin, Grosch, Jang-Wald, well, the Hüsken-Ilmanin jumping idea, I guess, that by definition, so let's see, go back to the flow here. So sigma of t is defined to be, I mean, let's ignore the word outermost for a second. It's a minimal area enclosure of the original horizon. And so as you're flowing along, you in fact can have jumps, such as here. But since it's a minimal area enclosure, it never jumps to something larger because then it wouldn't be a minimal area enclosure, right? Because then this would be smaller. And it never jumps to something smaller because if a smaller surface existed out there, it would have already jumped out there. Right? And so those two arguments combine that when it jumps, actually the area is exactly the same when it jumps.
And how do we see that, in fact, along this flow, no new horizons are formed somewhere? I mean, it's intuitively.
Right. So you can form horizons. So suppose that after a while, it's a make point, it probably wouldn't happen, but maybe somehow or another you got a horizon right there. Well, I mean, there is a horizon here. However, sigma of t is not defined to be the outermost horizon. Right. So I'll answer that, even though I see not you understand, but I'll answer it for everyone else. There's no... This is supposed to be a minimal area enclosure of the original horizons. There's no need to include this component of a horizon with sigma of t because it would simply increase the area, and you're actually better off just not including that component. And so you just ignore it. And so, in fact, you can show the number of components by that argument is always not increasing.
Could you say a little bit about your current thoughts on allowing for non-time symmetric initial data?
Okay, well, so this is definitely the next direction to go and what physicists, I'm sure, would be very interested in. I mean, throughout this entire discussion, I've assumed that, I mean, this is sort of the simplest case, and this is the case that when you have a maximal slice, you have a metric with non-negative scalar curvature, then there's this whole harmonic conformal class of metrics, and everything's very, very nice and simple and very uncomplicated. And once you introduce the second fundamental form, it's not clear to me yet exactly how that affects things. And so it's something I'm certainly thinking about right now. It's really the next direction to go. And I think Bob Wald is going to give some discussion on what is the Penrose conjecture for a general. Are you going to do that on Saturday?
No.
No, okay. Well, now he is. No, there's a physical motivation for what that conjecture should be for a general slice. It's very, very similar. I mean, you still have the mass at infinity, but there's the issue of what do apparent horizons look like, and they no longer become zero mean curvature surfaces. It's something a little bit more complicated. So,
just to very briefly comment on that. I mean, the argument in favor, I mean, or the motivating idea behind the conjecture, I mean, has to do with the fact that the event horizon of a black hole has to lie outside apparent horizon, and you have an area increase theorem, and if things settle down to a black hole, you'd have that inequality for Schwarzschild holding as an equality, or if it was a Kerr, it would hold as an inequality. And putting all those steps together, you know, motivate the idea that if cosmic censorship is right and things settle down to stationary black holes, you should have that inequality holding on an arbitrary initial data set. The difficulty with generalizing this to the non-time symmetric case, I mean, you could prove, I think, immediately in the maximal slice case the same mathematical result concerning, you know, M greater than, you know, area of appropriate surface. But the trouble is that the surface you want now, that you would want in the conjecture, is the area of the smallest surface that encloses an apparent horizon. And in the time symmetric case, an apparent horizon, that is zero convergence of the outgoing null G at Essex because of the zero extrinsic curvature of the space-like slice, is identical to a minimal surface in the hypersurface. But once you have the trace of extrinsic curvature non-zero, that connection is lost. So you now want to prove something much more complicated about, you know, surface enclosing minimum area surface that encloses a surface that is not minimal, but, you know, satisfies this relationship between its trace extrinsic curvature in the slice and the extrinsic curvature in the radial in the outgoing normal direction. So I think that's the problem with the main problem with generalizing it away from the non-time symmetric case.
I will say one direction of generalization which does look promising anyway is to higher dimensions. And so if you notice in the argument which I gave, I didn't use the Gauss-Monnet formula, for example, and the positive mass theorem is true in higher dimensions. So mostly I would say it hinges on the positive mass theorem. And so since the positive mass theorem is n-dimensional theorem, this technique should at least give you something in higher dimensions. And since this is a physics conference, I'm allowed to speculate maybe a little bit. I would speculate that, in fact, it does go through and you do get a similar inequality where you use Schwarzschild metric as your case of equality and then generalize from there, which is something that the inverse mean curvature flow doesn't seem to do because it uses the Gauss-Monnet formula.
There is a different approach to this Penrose inequality. Using Bondi mass instead of ADM mass and null counts.
Mm-hmm.
About 15 years ago, James Vickers and I proved a version of this theorem under quite strong asymptotic conditions at Scry.
Mm-hmm.
We had to essentially, I think, as far as I remember, we had to assume it's rather Schwarzschild-like at Scry, which was a very strong condition.
Mm-hmm.
But with these new results, mm-hmm. where one can assume to a high degree approximation mm-hmm. something is Schwarzschild mm-hmm. at infinity, the proof might be more, could be generalized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there is another approach which doesn't use minimal surfaces. It mm-hmm. uses null cones rather mm-hmm. than surfaces. Mm-hmm. But it is restricted to just one, a trap surface,
mm-hmm.
a single trap surface.
Mm. Yeah, and so you proved the positive mass term in that setting.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, so it definitely seems like the techniques that Rick discuss perhaps could be helpful. It's not clear, obviously, what the exact geometry. I'm not an expert on this, so you have to talk to Rick maybe and see if this works out. And also, to be clear, the fact that I was assuming the metric could be conformally flat outside of a compact set is something that Shane and Yao did in their second proof of the positive mass theorem paper, and has been around for some time. So assuming conformal flatness outside a compact set is so I guess at this point it's a standard technique.
So since you agreed to speculate about the higher dimensional case, I'll ask you a little bit about that.
Okay.
There was some interest earlier in the conference about these sort of long wrapped black strings. And so I'm just going to say that, or wondering if, in the high-dimensional case, it seems like there might be an additional complication that some of your middle surfaces might not be spheres. There might be some more complicated topology. Is that going to, you know, impact the flow of the proof in a major way? Or am I wrong? Do you think they will be spheres?
I'm not the person to ask on that. Who's the, like to comment on that, actually? The topology of horizons in higher dimensions?
Well, just topology of minimal surfaces to start with.
Yeah. So, take a volunteer on that. But, So a more general question in terms of, like, first of all, did I use the fact that there's spheres at any point? And there the answer is no. So maybe Rick can comment on that.
Yeah, just in terms of topology of minimal surfaces in higher dimensions, you wouldn't expect to be able to control it well.
Right, from stability.
There's no, if when you minimize area, there's really no way of controlling the topology, except
right.
in the surface case.
Right. Yeah. So I guess the stability argument, which I'm familiar with, uses the Gosse-Vinet formula. So I guess that does internalize higher dimensions. But in any case, I never. It doesn't seem to be important. In that, really, the real issue is reflecting along the horizon. And actually, what I'm most concerned about is that in high enough dimensions, minimal surfaces can have singularity. They don't have to be smooth. So they have these conical singularities of codimension 7. And so the interesting question is, in my techniques, I have to reflect through these minimal surfaces. And so what I'm very interested in studying is understanding these singularities so that you can, well enough, so you can do a reflection and continue these arguments.
I guess I'm holding the mic. I don't know that. let's see. So if I understood correctly, you can allow sort of positive scalar curvature, or at least as long as it's not negative, you can apply the argument. So roughly speaking, you can have matter outside the horizon, and all that matter sort of gets swallowed up by the horizon in your flow.
Mm-hmm.
But now suppose you start with an extreme black hole,
mm-hmm.
in which on your initial surface the horizon is sort of infinitely far away down a throat.
Mm-hmm.
Would it still work and flow to a Schwarzschild?
So you're talking about something like this.
That's right.
Okay. So it's a Schwarzschild outside here, and then there's a cylinder, or what's the is the scalar curvature still?
Well,
the
this is like
positive here.
It's extreme Reiser Nordstrom, so the scalar
right.
curvature is everywhere going to be positive.
Okay. Everywhere.
And, well, it goes to zero at infinity. It's asymptotically right. flat in exactly the usual way.
Okay, and it's positive everywhere.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, as long as the scalar curvature is positive, then and it's asymptotically flat, then you should get this, an inequality. I guess.
There's no minimal surface
outside
right.
of
right.
Right. It asymptotically
so
approaches
is it,
this.
Does it become does it continue to shrink?
No. Finite.
Okay.
The two spheres have finite radius, a constant radius. It's a cylinder.
This is a cylinder?
Yeah.
Okay, but it's not quite a minimal sphere. So the minimal sphere would be at the very bottom.
That's right. Exactly.
Okay, well, I mean, so if as long as there's not negative star curvature, then, you know, be very surprised if you couldn't just do some modification to get a minimal surface of the metric and improve the inequality. I have to look at it exactly since I'm not familiar with this precisely, but as long as if there almost exists a minimal surface, then it should still be true. You probably just go multiply through by a conformal factor to make it a horizon, just a guess, but.
A couple of questions based on actually previous people's comments. And so Bob pointed out this interesting thing that as it stands, right, I mean, if we just look at maximal surfaces, trace k equal to zero,
mm-hmm.
then everything is, as it stands mathematically, everything goes through,
mm-hmm.
Although we cannot really say that the, you still have inequality, but that inequality
right.
would refer to these areas of minimal right. surfaces, but not apparent horizons.
Right.
So that by itself is an interesting result, right? I mean, I've never heard about this before. I mean, or suspected that something like that should be true, that if you give yourself some initial data, maximum slicing in physics literature at least is not considered as too strong a thing. I mean, and so there's a very generic result that you actually have this ADM mass is like going to be bigger than or equal to the minimal surface if it exists anywhere in that. I mean, so it's in some sense stronger than the original Penrose in one direction original Penrose conjecture.
It's interesting to try. Figure out what it means, I guess.
Second thing was
the extra curvature is just like adding gravitational waves outside.
I mean, in retrospect, it is like that. I mean, it's understandable, but I think at least that's okay. I didn't understand Malcolm's comments. I mean, so Malcolm, are you saying that in fact in the positive energy theorem that you had with James Vickers, you could actually say that under some strong assumptions or whatever, you could actually show that the boundary mass was bigger than the area of the apparent horizon, or was it just positive? I mean,
the boundary mass is bigger than the area, or the square root of the area.
I see.
But under quite small divisions on psi minus, let it get under psi minus, from above surface down to psi minus. But we had a quite strong,
it doesn't sky minus, not on the sky plus.
Yeah.
I see. And the last quick question was, you said about higher dimensions thing. Just stupid thing, I don't know. Is it true that in higher dimensions one could also take sort of Schwarzschild to be conformally flat?
Yes.
Oh.
Right. So, what is a Schwarzschild metric in higher dimensions? It's defined to be spherically symmetric and zero scalar curvature. And then, actually, it's very similar. I can write it down, just R3 or Rn. You take a harmonic function, 1 plus some constant over x to the n minus 2 to the power of 4 over n minus 2 delta ij. So Rn minus the origin. That's what would be the Schwarzschild metric in higher dimensions.
Is the Penrose quotient in higher dimensions the same expression, or is there a different power of the volume?
Yeah, so in general, the mass has units of n minus 2, length to the power of n minus 2. So, and so you take the Penrose quotient. So, let's see, make everything. So this has length of n minus 2, let's put a 1 over n minus 2 there, and then see the area, which now is hypervolume, has units of n minus 1, so that would work. You can multiply through by, that would be scale invariant, then multiply square if you want to, or whatever. The original one. There's one other thing which I thought maybe I'd show, and then Sean Hayward, maybe we'd get up and say something, but about the non-time symmetric case. But there's this Hawking mass, it's a quasi-local mass in the higher dimensional, the original approach I showed with the which Huskin and Illman recently and the Yang and Wald and Grosch used, you had this quasi-local mass, the Hawking mass, to prove the Penrose inequality. And so you might ask, well, here's another proof of the Penrose inequality. Do you get a quasi-local mass function? And the answer is yes. So let me show you what that is. Something that maybe physicists would be particularly interested in. And so what you do is suppose you have original asymptotically flat manifold with some surface sigma, and one thing that's different about this quasi-local mass is it works for multiple components. So you can talk about, so the Hawking mass is only monotone when you have one component, and it's monotone over inverse mean curvature flow, but here we're going to allow multiple components. And so take your original metric, G, and multiply it through by a conformal factor, which is harmonic, so in the original metric, so use harmonic, and has to be positive, and such that the surface you're interested in, sigma, now has zero mean curvature. So it forms a horizon. Then, to make this a horizon, you can't always do this, but suppose you can. Then for the surfaces which you can, this is still not unique up to a factor. So the fact that it's harmonic and sigma has zero mean curvature, which is like a mixed Neumann-Dirichlet boundary condition, then there's still a scale invariance here. And you choose a scaling of the conformal factor such that the mass at infinity is preserved. So the ADN mass of this guy equals the ADN mass of this new metric. That fixes the conformal factor. And then what you do is you define the mass of sigma in the original metric to be just the square root of the area of sigma in this new metric over 16 pi. And so it turns out that this quantity is monotone under the flow I've defined here. Actually, what you can do is, even though I flowed the metric, what you can do is you can say, well, just look at where the horizons go and think of the metric as being fixed. That defines the flow of the horizon sigma of t. And so this definition of quasi-local mass is monotone under this flow sigma of t, and also it works for multiple components. And also the point is it's reasonably computable, conceivably anyway. It's a little harder to compute than the Hawking mass, but theoretically you could work it out in certain situations. So maybe, one more question for this one. Yeah?
Just a question about this definition. If you take initial data and you pick your sigmas, now you modify the initial data in some region of your surface away from sigma, I mean, far from sigma.
Okay.
Is it clear that you will get the same mass inside sigma?
You don't. Believe you don't. So
it's sort of non-local in that sense.
That's right. So in that way, it's not as good as the Hawking mass, because at least the Hawking mass is local. You can compute it. And so what's interesting, though, is it's sort of cheats. It sort of sees what's going to happen and sort of anticipates things. And so I still haven't figured out if that's a good feature or a bad feature yet. But the ideal thing, if you use Bartnik mass as a motivation for what quasi-local mass ought to be, then ideally you should be able to compute it in terms of the local geometry of sigma, just the metric and second fundamental form of sigma. Okay. So maybe, Sean, if you want to maybe describe. Sean has worked on this problem with second fundamental form, so I thought it would be interesting to see what he has to say.
You want to use this?
Give the mic.
Yeah, please. I just thought I'd start by repeating what Bob Wald said about the motivation for the Penrose inequality. Does anyone have a set of transparency? I can just write away here. Okay. Yeah. So. The original idea was to do with cosmic censorship. You imagine you have an initial spatial hypersurface with some black hole of a certain area, and let's suppose it's asymptotically flat, and one measures the ADN mass at infinity. Then what one expects to happen is that this black hole will eventually settle down to a Schwarzschild or curved black hole. So it may pick up some matter or radiation as it goes along, but eventually it will settle down to a Schwarzschild black hole. And in the process, the area will be increasing. And if it comes down to a Schwarzschild black hole in the end, the Penrose inequality hold here for the final value. We'll hold for the final value of the area. And we also have the Bondi energy loss result, which says that the energy is decreasing there. And so therefore the Penrose inequality must hold for the ADN mass in terms of this original area. And that's just a problem in Riemannian geometry. So by studying that problem, we might learn something about the evolution. In particular, if the inequality does not hold, there is some initial data set for which it's not true, and it can't develop into a finely stationary Schwarzschild black hole according to this scenario. So there would be something very wrong with our understanding of black holes. So I just thought I'd show you that before. So I wanted to talk about a proof of the Penrose inequality in spherical symmetry, but without any time symmetry. So this is a truly dynamic case. It would apply, for instance, to some supernova explosion or whatever. And the proof is very simple. It doesn't require any complicated mathematics. So let me just... in spherical symmetry, you just take the area of the sphere of symmetry. I'll use R to denote the aerial radius. And you can classify surfaces according to the causal nature of the gradient of this area. This defines trap surfaces, marginally trapped surfaces, and what I've just called untrapped surfaces. So for a black hole, one would expect a picture like this. So this is a black hole formed by gravitational collapse of some kind of matter falling in here. One expects the formation of a region of trapped surfaces, some boundary consisting of marginally trapped surfaces, and both outside of the untrapped surfaces. We're going to measure the area of the black hole by a surface in this hypersurface, one of the marginal surfaces. Now, the only other point I need to mention here is that an untrapped surface has a spatial orientation, and that's just determined by the fact that the gradient of the area is spatial. That means the area is increasing in the two null directions, and therefore it's increasing in any spatial direction outward from the black hole. So this is important because it gives us a local orientation in the untrapped region. So we don't even have to assume asymptotic flatness or anything like that. As long as we're in an untrapped region, we know which way is inside and which way is outside. So the one idea, has already been mentioned, is just to have a definition of energy which holds not just at infinity, but throughout the space-time. And there's a very standard one in spherical symmetry. I think it was first given by Meisner and Sharp. It's been rediscovered by many people, including Hawking. It's appeared in several of the talks given at this conference. And it's just defined in terms of the area and its first derivative. And you don't have to read all these properties here. This was a slide for a later talk. The only important one is the first one here, that it does agree with the Pondian ADM mass at infinity. It also takes the standard value on a black hole. So E is greater than or equal to or less than a half R. That's just another way to say the Penrose inequality on trapped, marginal, or untrapped spheres. So I've actually already written this here. E is a half R anywhere on this hypersurface, and will be greater inside a black hole. And then the key result is this monotonicity result. Assuming the dominant energy condition, E is essentially increasing in an outward achronal direction in the untrapped region. And this is just a calculation from the Einstein equation. You just work out the derivative of E, and this turns out to be true. This immediately proves the Penrose inequality in a very simple way. Just start at any surface here where E is half R zero. You move out in any achronal direction, any spatial or null direction. The energy is increasing, and therefore it must satisfy the Penrose inequality outside. And if space time is asymptotically flat, you go all the way out to infinity, you get the same inequality. And similarly, if it goes to my infinity, you get the same thing for the bond condition. As I say, you now no longer even have to assume the space-time is asymptotically flat, because the result holds anywhere outside the black hole. More precisely, anywhere in the untrapped region, achronally outwards from the local horizon of your chosen moment of time. Yeah, that's right. So this is a very simple and physical proof in the strictly symmetric case that will hold even for a violently, dynamically evolving black hole. So this, combined with these recent results that Hugh was talking about, I think is pretty strong evidence that it's true in general, and that maybe we can work on how to do it soon. And I'll just mention one idea to do that. Again, I'll use the Hawking energy. This is an energy associated with any spatial surface in space-time. You don't actually have to understand what the definition is. It's just a quantity associated with spatial surfaces. And it turns out that the Hawking energy has some similar properties to the Meissner-Sharp energy, including in particular monotonicity properties. Let me just put that there so you can compare. I've given standard definitions of trapped and marginal surfaces. What I need now is an analog of what I call untrapped over there. I've defined mean convex surfaces by essentially the opposite sign condition that holds the trapped surfaces. So this means that one of these expansions will be positive. So these are the null expansions of the surface in the two null normal dimensions. So one of these null expansions will be positive and the other negative, and this automatically gives a local spatial orientation to these mean convex surfaces. Mean convex is, of course, not used in the usual sense in Riemannian geometry, but it's a similar idea. And there is a monotonicity result for these mean convex surfaces, assuming the dominant energy condition. And again, it's a straightforward calculation from the Einstein equation. There's some more terms than they were in the strictly symmetric case. But you still find that E is non-decreasing on outward uniformly expanding families of surfaces. And uniformly expanding here just means that the expansions are constant on each surface.
Uniformly expanding would be analogous to inverse mean curvature flux.
Yes.
And
therefore, by exactly the same argument, you get the Penrose inequality holding for the Hawking energy outside the black hole, as far as this uniformly expanding foliation exists. So, if one wants to prove the Penrose inequality in the original sense, one has to know whether this foliation will exist globally, and that's the open question. If some mathematician is interested in that, please go ahead and look at it. On the other hand, this result will still hold, even if you don't have an asymptotically flat space line, this still holds in a local sense outside the black hole. So, that's all I wanted to say.
We are very late. One question? Everybody's hungry, so let's thank the speaker again and have lunch.